clear and concise. This is the Jason Burma Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
Living in the upside down, the dark cartoon, a post-truth world, if you will. It is the norm. And the headline that I just could not get over this afternoon was Anthony Blinken out in a Kiev bar rocking out to Keep on Rocking in the Free World. Again, you can't make this stuff up, and I wish it was nothing more than a deep fake meme, but it is a harsh reality. Now, even today on my other program, I mentioned Blinken because I do think that amongst the people within the Biden administration, Anthony Blinken is a very, very capable sociopath slash psychopath. He has remnants of that old school Bush administration feel. He would be right there with a Dick Cheney or a Paul Wolfowitz, and was really right there during the Barack Stars administration. In fact, if you watch or take a look at some of the photographs from the supposed Bin Laden raid, where everybody's like, oh, I'm a big time, look at all this, pointing, you'll notice Blinken's in there. So he's been an A-list player for some time. Now, when I watch this, I mean, first of all, I'm not trying to rag on the Ukrainian people. I want them to live a normal, peaceful life. But what I don't want is some third-rate non-rock star in a bar introducing somebody from the U.S. presidential administration that gets up there and goes, times are rough over in Kharkiv up there. People are really taking a hit. He's like, but it's okay because we've got your back and freedom's got your back. And so is the free world. So let's try something out right here. What do you think, guys? I mean, that is remnants of old school George W. Bush stuff. And when I look at Blinken, again, I don't like to pick on people's looks, but he looks like an evil version of whistleblower Anthony Schaefer. So if you know who Anthony Schaefer is, this is a gentleman who was actually in military intelligence. He was part of a program called Able Danger that actually identified the 9/11 hijackers, get this everybody, prior to 9/11 and tried to warn different departments about them. Now, Schaefer and others would blow the whistle after the fact. The Defense Department, Pentagon, you name it, they would all, we don't know what he's talking about. I don't know what he's talking about. There were actually hearings on this. Senator Kurt Weldon brought it before the Senate, I believe. They showed the charts. They gave the timeline. Schaefer made it clear that he was no Boy Scout and did not spend his time in the quote-unquote Christian Science Monitor reading room, all right? He had the goods. He felt bad. He tried to go public. Instead, he was smeared. I will say this. He has become somewhat of a more mainstream pundit. But every time I look at Anthony Blinken, I see like bizarro world Anthony Schaefer. Plus, they share the first same name. It's a damn shame. Folks, on top of that, I thought I would be remiss not to mention that somebody like Jimmy Carter looks to be on his last legs from the pictures that I've seen. Will probably be announcing his death within the week, if not the month at most. And the reason I bring him up is amongst the warmongering and the 60 plus billion to the Ukraine, we just gave another billion to Israel. And of all of Jimmy Carter's faults, and there were many, he rightfully identified what the Israeli state was, and it was an apartheid state. And he wrote a book and went on a tour, and there's a documentary, Peace Not Apartheid. That's Jimmy Carter, the ex-president. You can't even say that right now without being a pro-Hamas lunatic in some circles. So I do want to point out And I also want to point out that he actually had to take apartheid out of the title from pressure after the fact because that was too hardcore all the way back in 2008, even though it was the truth. But we've moved away from the truth so much that we live in a post-truth world. In that post-truth world, we hope that you give us a follow on social media across the board. X, Facebook, Getter, Gab, you name it. We're on all of them. And then if you'd like to support the truth, people like myself speaking about Tony Blinken being a total fake. Decent on the guitar, yes. The vocals weren't there, Tony. We both know it. Please consider the donation. 5, 10, 15 bucks, big donations. It's what's going to keep TNT thriving, not just surviving. So please make that donation if you can. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to hit the headlines after this with more TNT.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Late on Monday, President Biden signed into law a bill that bans U.S. imports of Russian uranium for use in nuclear fuel, despite warnings that the move could backfire on the American economy. Here with the story. Joining me now is TNT News producer Adam Clark to bring the ruckus. What do you got for us today, Adam?
All right. So this is actually the first of two bipartisan stories I'm bringing today. So, yes, this is bipartisan legislation, which Biden signed on Monday. Why is this an issue, by the way, real quick? Russia, until recently, has remained America's top foreign source of these crucial nuclear fuel. You can use this stuff. Nuclearly. This is despite tensions over the Ukraine conflict. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claims that this is going to, quote, strengthen our nation's energy and economic security by reducing and ultimately eliminating our reliance on Russia for civilian nuclear power, end quote. The measure was unanimously passed by the Senate in late April, and it will now go into effect, end quote. The measure was unanimously passed by the Senate in late April, and it will now go into effect in about 90 days. However, the U.S. Department of Energy can issue waivers until the year 2028 in cases where there are no alternatives to the Russian low-enriched uranium, or if its shipments are in the national interest. The ban also provides, a big number here, $2.7 billion in federal funding to build new enrichment capacity in America to boost its civilian nuclear industry. Russian ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonov, condemned the ban, accusing Washington of persisting in, quote, its stillborn policy of inflicting a strategic economic defeat on us. Furthermore, quote, the current attack not only on Russia, but also on the world market for uranium fuel used in nuclear power plants leads to new shocks in international economic relations, end quote. This is what the envoy said, warning that the move would boomerang. Quote, the financial losses for the United States will be much greater than for Russia, end quote. That's what Antonov says. He also argued that U.S. sanctions are failing to undercut Russia. Well, of course he would say that. Quote, reality has shown that the Russian economy is ready for any challenges and quickly responds to emerging difficulties, even extracting dividends from the situation, end quote. Clever. As of 2022, Russia was the largest enriched uranium exporter on the global market, with an estimated export value of $2 billion. According to data from the U.S. Energy Department, it accounts for about a quarter of the uranium used in U.S. reactors. Against this backdrop, Bloomberg has reported that the ban, quote, carries risks, end quote. Jonathan Hinz, president of a nuclear fuel market research firm, UXC, told the outlet that the legislation could lead to a 20% hike in uranium prices. Ah, Bidenomics. In December, Bloomberg cited sources as saying that Tenex, T-E-N-E-X, a Russian overseas trading company owned by Russian state corporation Rosatom, had warned its American customers that Moscow could preemptively bar nuclear fuel exports to the U.S. if a uranium ban were approved. And here we are. However, at the time, Rosatom dismissed the report as, quote unquote, inaccurate, insisting that Tenex, quote, is fulfilling all of its contractual obligations and will continue to do so, end quote. Well, you know, until Biden steps in. Anyways, Jason, what say you about this report?
Well, number one, I am a large proponent of nuclear energy, especially, you know, third, fourth, and now fifth generation nuclear energy. It is much safer than people think. When you get into the economics of it, I must say it is surprising, but not shocking, that we're still doing business with Russia in this aspect. You would think that Russia would not want to sell that nuclear energy, even if it was at a commercial capacity, aka this enriched uranium, because it strengthens the United States economy. But we also have to look at, again, I often talk about the non-space race. There's obviously some alliances and allegiances that we are not privy to. Baked into that, you noticed that number one, through 2028, this is going to continue. And number two, there will be exceptions along the way. I actually think it's a good thing to start enriching uranium and building those facilities inside the United States safely, of course. And I would hope in areas that if there was some type of disaster, it would be in a more rural community. Let's just say that. But, you know, when I look at this stuff, I think that the Russians are actually right. I don't really think that they're spitting out too much propaganda here. When we put these sanctions, the economic sanctions against Russia, before Ukraine really broke out and well into that, what? It was like a month before Russia fully recovered, and then actually their economy expanded while ours continued to retract. Those are real numbers. I think that when you're looking at Russia, you're looking at a very, very different type of economy. You know, let's be honest, for a very, very long time, the United States' number one export, physical export, has been garbage. Yes, garbage, folks. That's it. That's what we got for you. Russia is not the same way. They literally are getting rid of real goods, real resources, such as enriched uranium. And this really keeps a solid nation state. Look, Russia's far from perfect. I'm not saying, you know, that I want to be the right-hand man of Vladimir Putin. But at the same time, we have to look at these realities and at the same time be suspect of what these things really mean, because it does seem there is some interest for Russia to keep the United States as the main balanced superpower. Otherwise, these deals, they would have been cut off long ago, and we wouldn't even be dealing with them in the first place, in my opinion, Adam.
Kind of strange, actually, now that I'm thinking about this. Back in the day when I was first, you know, watching you and Alex Jones and all of those crew back in the day, there was this concept that we understood that we wanted to steer away from this idea of globalism, right? And then we wanted to, you know, close our shores, close our borders, and start taking care of ourselves. And here we are. And now that we're doing it the way we're doing it, I'm finding it to be a little frightening. It's almost as if like we're having like some sort of rug just instantly ripped out from underneath us, and we're not quite ready for it. But that's just how I feel about this kind of stuff when I see these reports, Jason.
Well, like, for instance, when we were all told to build back better, and then the United States tried to pass a build back better bill. Well, too many people were just like, well, I don't want to do that. This isn't something that was just spontaneously made up by Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, despite what she claims. We saw people talking about this for months, if not over a year, before they tried to pass it. So it doesn't pass, you know, too much court of public opinion backlash. Then they just rename it the infrastructure bill. Builds no infrastructure, sets nothing up, is almost the same exact thing as the quote unquote build back better bill. And the build back better bill really does mean shutting off the power, not building the proper infrastructure, and not having the type of reserves that we should. Listen, to me, it was completely treasonous that this administration not only sold off a vast number of our oil reserves, but then decided to let them loose, what, to take the price of the pump down 3 to 10 cents for about a month and a half. It was a bad joke. But at the same time, they don't want to turn the pipelines back on. They don't want to start drilling. They don't want to go back to fracking. And for all its troubles, okay, that part of the power industry is still extremely important. I'm not saying give up on solar. I may not be the biggest fan of wind, but at the same time, I think maybe there are some places there. It's been disastrous trying to implement these things on a large scale level, and people don't even want to look at the realities of EVs, the cost of maintaining them, and then, oh yeah, the carbon or energy put into making them. That's the big ha-ha moment, that making those cars saves none of your quote-unquote imagination land carbon footprint. Adam, we're going to see you in the next hour. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got a lot to talk about with Derek Brose. He's got two bangers out there, one on The Last American Vagabond, the other over at The Conscious Resistance. You're not going to want to miss it. More TNT after this.
TNT's Mark Morano.
Doug Burgum. Donald Trump, if you're listening, please X him off the list. Doug Burgum is North Dakota governor. He claims to be a small-time governor. Small town or small whatever governor, small state governor. He ran for president. The problem is, he used to work for Microsoft. He's personal friends with Bill Gates. Bill Gates gave him money to run for politics. He says nice things about Bill Gates. And on my Twitter account, at Climate Depot, you can read all about this. And he also, as far as I know, didn't object to Bill Gates buying up agricultural land and other things. He is clearly, Doug Burgum, all presentations aside that he's the small-time anti-establishment guy, you can't get more establishment than being personal friends with Bill Gates and taking money from him.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
Many pollution sources can affect the air you breathe, from power plants and vehicles to dust and wildfires. Knowing more about local air quality can help you protect your health. If you're thinking about buying an air sensor, EPA has a series of videos to help you get the most out of it. Learn how EPA collects and uses regulatory data, how EPA communicates health messaging, and how to interpret the readings from your sensor. Visit epa.gov/air-sensor-toolbox.
On air 24/7, this is today's News Talk TNT.
We are now joined by an independent journalist of the highest order. You can check his work out over at The Last American Vagabond. And, of course, The Conscious Resistance, of which he is. Derek, thank you so much for joining us. Mr. Bros, you've got this article out there about Bethany Christian Services, and this is an adoption firm. Now, I've known you've done some bangers of investigations in the past into the Mormon Church, for instance, the Finders cult, and beyond. First of all, tell us the basics about this and where you think this ranks among those investigations.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jason, for giving me some time to get into this. This is my latest investigation. There's going to be a couple more pieces coming out. And like with the Utah case that you mentioned and a few of my other investigations that have related to trafficking and cults and this one more about the foster service and adoption industry, this came through listeners, through supporters. I have a couple of sources who reached out to me who were directly impacted by Bethany Christian Services. I will say right off the bat, they're currently not ready to come out in public because of fear of retribution by Bethany Christian Services. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But just to sum up who they are, as their name implies, a Christian adoption service. They provide what they say, like pregnancy care. They encourage mothers who are maybe considering abortions to consider adoption instead. And they partner with hospitals as well as the federal government, the U.S. federal government. So they have contracts. Let's say a mother comes in, a young mother, and she says, I'm considering an abortion, but they'll bring in a counselor from Bethany Christian Services to talk to her and, get her to consider adoption and to do what they call an open adoption. And as it sounds, it's supposed to be an open adoption where the parent or parents who are giving up the child are still able to communicate with the child throughout their life, maybe send them letters. It's all different situations, but generally the idea, they tell them, look, it'll be better for your baby to go to a home that can take care of them. You'll still be able to have visits. You'll be able to make phone calls. You'll send Christmas cards and all these kinds of things. We'll also provide counselors and therapists to help you through this whole process. And that's what they promote, at least. And in many cases, as I found, and as I've been told by various sources now, those promises are not kept at all. And in fact, it ends up being where the birth parents are sort of cut out of the situation. And in many cases, they feel they were deceived. I talked to, and I write about in my article, numerous people who had their children at 16, 17, maybe 18, even just in that young age range, who just weren't ready to have kids. They were already in obviously traumatic kind of situation trying to navigate that. Maybe some people, of course, could be getting pregnant the results of a rape or even in involuntary relationships. There's all sorts of situations that put people in that place. The point being, once they get to that place, if they decide they don't want the child, Bethany Christian Services will show up and start making these big promises. Once they go through with those deals and they sign away their parental rights, essentially, things all of a sudden change. The foster parents who adopt them, many cases, will turn their back on them and stop communication. There's at least one case that I document in the article of a 17-year-old girl who did not know she was pregnant, ends up having a baby and freaks out, says, I can't have this baby, I can't tell my parents. Then later on does tell her parents and regrets it. Thankfully, that all happened within this 28-day waiting period, and she was able to get her baby back. But she said specifically, I felt manipulated by Bethany Christian Services. They came in there. They took advantage of me. I was only 16. I think she was 16 or 17 at the time, so not necessarily an adult in all states, and gets them to sign these papers to sign away their children. And that's just sort of the basic core of it. There's also concerns about Bethany Christian Services and their contracts with the federal government relating to migrant children and them being shipped all over different places. And, we can get into all that.
Yeah, let's definitely get into that. But let's start here. We never want to hear that an organization that is supposedly there to help children is harming children. Yet over and over again, we've seen abuses within institutions like CPS, within foster care and homes, and even some of these charities, specifically Catholic and Christian homes, where they found dead bodies of children after the fact. I still remember the movie Sleepers with Brad Pitt, et cetera, and all these kids that had been abused in these homes and kind of tossed aside. That's more commonplace than people want to imagine. Now let's add on to that this aspect where it seems like there may be bounties on these children and more of a reason to try to convince these younger people to give these kids up for adoption, especially in the sense that it seems they already have parents in place that are going to take them. Correct, Eric?
Yeah, there was one case that I found, because once you start digging into this, I mean, first off, you search the name Bethany Christian Services, you're not going to find much mainstream reporting on them. If it does, it probably sings the praises of them. They've been around for 80 years. They've done wonderful work. And that all may be true. I'm not trying to discount anything positive they may have done. But absolutely, it's also true that these other problems do exist. And I've found in Michigan, which is where they're originally based, numerous violations of child adoption regulations and laws, found lawsuits against them in California. I've heard of numerous lawsuits and been able to find the record. Again, some of these people don't necessarily want to come out public just yet. There have been people who've been sued by Bethany Christian Services, including in this other case I cover, of a man who's for the last 5 years been trying to get his daughter back. He had a wife, or you know, a girlfriend, baby mama, whatever you want to say, who was not doing well, was on drugs. She got pregnant. She signed over the parental rights without him having any notification of this. And he's since been trying to get his child back. Bethany Christian Services actually sued him and the foster parents to try to prevent and to try to sever his parental rights, which is just crazy. You think about that, like a company, a nonprofit, being able to sue a parent or to try to get the courts to sever their parental rights, which is just, to me, it's mind-boggling. But this man is still out there trying to fight to get his daughter back. And there's other cases I found where, as you mentioned, families are available and they're ready and willing to take the child that somebody, you know, wants to give up. But in many cases, Bethany Christian Services has been found to ignore that and go with other people. And there is this whole other angle that I think you, your audience might be interested in. It's this, and it relates to the Betsy DeVos and her whole family and her brother being Eric Prince, you know, obviously a Blackwater, all that stuff.
We can get into that. Derek, hold it right there, because we're going to take a break. We'll get into that very, very concerning aspect on the other side. Yes, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater and a questionable individual, to say the least. We're going to take that break. We're going to hit some headlines. We're going to come back with Derek Bros of the Conscious Resistance. More TNT after this.
Deadline. TNT Radio News.
Big news.
Yeah!
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The Arizona Supreme Court has denied Planned Parenthood's request to immediately block the enforcement of a historic abortion ban, but has granted the State Attorney General Chris Mays an additional 90 days to consider appealing the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has informed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that the long-awaited $61 billion military aid package approved by Congress is being dispatched to Ukraine, with expectations it will significantly impact the battlefield dynamics.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And we are back with Derek Bros. You can check out his latest, the one we're discussing, over at thelastamericanvagabond.com. Now, we talked about some of the aspects, but get into this connection with Eric Prince, Betsy DeVos, everything.
Yeah, so the interesting thing I found about this, that, you know, the DeVos, I'm not sure, is that how you pronounce it? I think DeVos, her family, yes. Betsy DeVos, who most people are familiar with because of the Trump administration. She was U.S. Secretary of Education. But her husband, who's the still living Richard DeVos Jr., his father, also famous and wealthy, they have the Betsy and Richard DeVos Foundation. There was also the Helen and Richard DeVos Foundation. Each family member seems to have their own foundation, their own nonprofit, where they're giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to different organizations. Now, this family is very much promotes themselves as a Christian family that advocates, and their money goes towards Christian organizations. So they have given hundreds of thousands and up to millions of dollars between as far back as 1998 and as recent as 2016, about $6 million between all their family foundations. The Eric Prince connection is because he is actually Betsy DeVos married into the family. She was originally Betsy Prince. Her brother, Eric Prince, the former Navy SEAL who founded Blackwater, or formerly known as Blackwater, now known as Academy. So the interesting thing I think about that is that you have these nonprofits who claim to be Christian, or you know, purportedly are Christian, and they're donating to this organization that has a really bad track record in numerous different ways. And even though it's not in the mainstream, as I show in my article, you go to Yelp reviews, you go to different reviews, agencies that are out there to review companies, and you see the comments and you hear people on social media if you search. But these families, the DeVos family, are giving a lot of money to them. And it seems like, from what I'm gathering and from previous research of other journalists, that these wealthy Christian evangelists are giving to groups like the Bethany Christian Services, which then discourage abortion, and however you feel about that, that's fine, but they discourage that and then promote adoption through the same organizations that they are funding through their donations. What I find interesting about that is Eric Prince also has made statements kind of promoting himself as some warrior for Christianity, that like some of the actions that Blackwater and them have taken are this sort of bigger picture. And I don't think it's mainstream Christianity, but some sort of like warrior for Christ type thing. And that seems to be somewhat prevalent in this. So that's just sort of, I think, a tangential connection. The bigger thing I would like to focus on for a moment is this immigrant connection. Of course, the policy, which was during the Trump administration, continues under the Biden administration. Again, however you feel about it is irrelevant for the moment. The fact is that they do and were separating children from parents. The court said they're supposed to stop it, but it seems to have continued under the Biden administration. And when that happens, they contract, the Department of Health and Human Services contracts with Bethany Christian Services to do temporary rehousing of these families. Now, theoretically, the children are supposed to eventually be taken back to their families, but we can imagine how difficult this can be if their parents, like, let's imagine the best case scenario, people who are genuinely coming over here from a war-torn country or something, looking for a better way of life, and they come with their family, they come illegally, they get caught, they get separated, the parents get held somewhere or sent back, and the child gets taken by Bethany Christian Services and housed in a home, and allegedly later rehomed, but there are concerns that there's some elements of trafficking or that the kids could get lost in the system. And I report on at least one state rep from Tennessee who in November 2021, they actually held a committee about this and about concerns about human trafficking. And he specifically accused Bethany Christian Services of being involved in trafficking. And he said, quote, they're hauling them all over the country and dropping them in neighborhoods, flying them in the middle of the night. And they actually had some Bethany Christian Services officials come in there and testify. But my point is, I do think that that's a thread that I'm just starting to pull, and I'm sure there's probably more there.
Well, I know that you're going to be keeping up on it over at The Last American Vagabond, especially with some of the whistleblowers that are not quite ready to come forward. We look forward to it. We still got a few minutes left in the segment. You got a piece up over at your own website, theconsciousresistance.com, on 15-minute cities. Give us an overview of that.
Yeah, so I wanted to just do a real kind of recap of smart cities, 15-minute cities, how they connect, and then try to suggest some solutions. Jason, you know, people like you and I have been talking about smart cities since 2015, 2016, you know, long ago. I did a documentary in 2019, 2020 called The 5G Trojan Horse, focused on that too. But in the last couple of years, more people are waking up to this, specifically the 15-minute city aspect. And I looked into it, and the gentleman who's most known for it, he actually just released a book about it. Of course, he announced it originally at a United Nations meeting. He's getting it working in Paris. We're seeing cities in Italy and parts of Canada and other cities becoming these testing grounds for implementing. You need a QR code to get in certain places. You can't drive on certain days, or you got to pay fees. The low traffic neighborhood. And as usual, you trace all this stuff back to the World Economic Forum, the United Nations. I show how in October 2019, the WEF and the G20 nations, they actually announced the G20 Global Smart Cities Alliance on Technology governance. So it's all the same players that we're seeing that are trying to push us in this direction. And one final point I'll make on that is I make the note that these ideas, as typical, are not necessarily bad on their own. The idea of sustainability, diversity, you know, it's not a bad thing on its own, but we have to look beyond the buzzwords that these organizations use, because when they describe 15-minute cities, it's like, don't you want to have a walkable city where, you know, the market's close to you and you can walk there or bike there? Those ideas don't sound bad on their own, but you have to look past the buzzwords and see what they're really talking about is removing the choice, the option to drive, to the option to decide what you put on your plate, etc. So the ideas, when done voluntarily, can be great, but what they're talking about is technocratic top-down control that start voluntarily and eventually get to a point where there is no choice.
Yeah, it's the limitation of movement. It is taking away the right to your persons and property because you are not a free human being. Organically, many of these quote-unquote 15-minute cities, Derek, they already exist. The infrastructure is there. You can already go down to the bodega or the mart in any major city. You can get a haircut within two blocks. You can get a coffee in five different places. They're not really offering anything if more, other than more restrictions outside of your quote-unquote zone and the loss of anonymity on any scale. Because in order to go to these places you're already allowed to go right now, you are going to have to access them with a unique QR code. Now, yes, you already have GPS on your phone. Yes, the Internet of Things is already very real. Yes, they have a profile on you based on all of this target data and your social media. But this is lockstep. In other words, you will have to log in to every transaction, even if you do not make one when you go into these things. And it is the rise of blockchain. It is the rise of smart contracts in a negative sense to build not only the Internet of Things, but really the Internet of Bodies, in my opinion, Derek. And that will lead us further into authoritarianism. And ultimately, if we don't stop it, slavery. Tell people where they can check out the articles and support you, brother.
Thank you so much, Jason. You can find the Smart Cities article at theconsciousresistance.com, and the Bethany Christian Services can be found at The Last American Vagabond on my author page. And I'll also mention, I just dropped the 14th episode of my 17-part documentary series, The Pyramid of Power. If you want to watch that, it's at thepyramidofpower.net.
Thank you so much, Derek Brose, everybody. We're going to take a quick break. We got Misty Winston on the other side. We're going to be talking about David McBride. Unfortunately, they have sentenced him. We had him on this program not too long ago. And quite frankly, enough people are not aware of that case. We're going to take a break and hit that with Misty after this. More TNT.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Those beans smell heavenly.
Give Mom a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, thank great you. Idea.
At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local. I can send you with the link.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying. By the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. To learn more, visit nature.org today.
Disassembling the lies and reassembling the truth. This is the Jason Burmis Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
Now, we were fortunate enough not too long ago to actually have David McBride on the program to tell his story. Unfortunately, he has now been sentenced to almost 6 years in prison, and ultimately, not many people outside of really his inner circle and the international news scene know his story, but it is a continued war on whistleblowers. To go over that and much more is Misty Winston. Misty, thank you so much for joining us. So for those unaware of who David McBride is and what this case is about, please give it to us in a nutshell.
Well, in a nutshell, David McBride is an incredibly courageous whistleblower from Australia who was an Australian military lawyer who started to recognize some really nefarious things taking place within the Australian military in Afghanistan and other locations. And after attempting to go through the proper channels in order to address those issues and realizing he was going to get nowhere in doing so, he decided to take that information and give it to the media. And he is now being, as you just mentioned, he's now just been sentenced to almost 6 years in prison for exposing war crimes.
So let's talk about that, because so many times these people do try to go through the proper channels over and over and over again. This happens, and then eventually they try to find some type of media outlet. John Kiriakou would be a great example of this. And you always know it's a real whistleblower when they do not roll out the silver spoon treatment, right? That Hollywood treatment. Every time we see one of these social media whistleblowers, basically they get out there, they're superstars. And it's always the same thing. They're warning us that if there aren't more restrictions and government regulations, social media is going to hurt us. Then on the flip side of that, you have people that have actually witnessed real physical harm to large swaths of innocent civilians across the world. They do everything they possibly can, kicking and screaming, to try to go within that system and change that system. No dice. They then go to the media, usually. The media totally and completely ignores them. That's happened a multitude of times. And then they find maybe one outlet that is willing to work with them. And then as soon as that happens, they are persecuted and then prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We now have this 6-year sentence. In David's case, what are the next steps? Obviously, there will be an appellate process, but more than likely, he'll be serving time during that appellate process.
Yeah, no question about it. We all know that the appeals process, regardless of where you live, is ridiculously arduous. It takes an incredibly long time to appeal any of these situations. So, yeah, I mean, he is spending his first day in jail. I mean, he was just sentenced, I mean, not even 24 hours ago. I think that the sentence came down around 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern yesterday. So it's not even been 24 hours. He is spending his first day in jail. And his attorneys, Mark Curtis, have said that they do intend to appeal. But of course, that's going to take some time. And so in the meantime, he is going to be spending a significant portion of his life. I think any portion of your life, a single day in prison is too much for somebody like David McBride, who should be celebrated. There should be a parade in his honor today. He shouldn't be spending his first day in prison. But yes, there's an appeals process that will take some time. And in the meantime, he is going to be forced to spend at least, I think he's on non-parole until August of 2026. So if the appeals process doesn't go through, he will be in prison until August of 2026. If he is forced to serve out his entire sentence, he will not be released until the year 2030.
And again, even at 2026, he has to make parole. And the way that he has, you know, obviously been smeared in the media and, you know, again, prosecuted successfully, there are no guarantees. And the appellate process, as you know, can also take years. I mean, let's talk really quickly about Julian Assange. He has now been in Belmarsh Prison for 5+ years. We are now waiting for that final judgment on extradition, which we are supposed to get before the end of the month, possibly within the next week
Monday.
Or two. Yes, it's supposed to be Monday. We'll see. I've heard it before. I'm not sure if we're actually going to get that or not. You know, we'll see. And I only say that because we have seen so many ups and downs in the Assange case. I think we're talking now, what, 3 years ago, Misty, we were discussing when you had the judge rule that he could not be extradited, but only because he felt like the United States could not keep Assange from committing suicide. They could not have the proper assurances. Years go by, and that is the main point of contention. When that isn't even a relevant thing. You're torturing this guy out in the open, and he's clearly not healthy. He clearly was not given the rights of any human being. Forget about U.S. citizen, which, again, they want to try him as a U.S. citizen via the Espionage Act, but not give him the rights of a U.S. citizen as they try him in a court of 100% conviction rate. So when you look at that process alone, let's say on Monday they do rule that extradition. Is that it? Is Assange just on his way to the United States?
I mean, if they do in fact deny the request for appeal, yes, he could be on a plane to the United States, which we should mention, first of all, he's not an American citizen. He's Australian. And so the idea that the United States is charging him under our Espionage Act while affording him none of the protections of the First Amendment is very much having your cake and eating it too. But that's the US, right? That's what we do. But yes, he could be on a plane to the country that was revealed to be plotting to murder him. There was a huge expose in Yahoo News where a multitude of unnamed and named sources from within intelligence reported to Michael Isikoff and other reporters that there were plots at the highest level levels of the Trump administration to assassinate Julian Assange. So the very idea that the UK court system is even considering extraditing this guy to this country is beyond my ability to comprehend. But yes, if the the request for appeal is denied, within an hour or two, he could be on a plane to the United States. As soon as the extradition order is signed, he could be on a plane to the United States. In my opinion, I don't think that that's likely to happen. I don't think that the United States wants to bring Julian Assange to the United States in the middle of an election year, especially given the fact that it looks bad for both teams. This is not something that Joe Biden can weaponize against Donald Trump. It's not something Donald Trump can weaponize against Joe Biden. They're both very much equal partners in the persecution of Julian Assange. So they would be very stupid, I think, to bring him here. I think that that opens up a Pandora's box that they don't really want to open. I think it opens up a lot of conversations that they don't really want to have. But I could be wrong. Listen, it would not surprise me if they were stupid enough to do it. But that is what we're looking at. Either the request for appeal will be approved, which, as we just talked about, that will then open up the appeals process, which will take forever. Who knows how long? Certainly, I think well past the election, or the request for appeal will be denied and he will be on a plane to the United States within hours.
Well, I will say this. We are in kind of a Forrest Gump moment in our political system here in the United States. So stupid is as stupid does, everybody. Yeah. We don't know.
Very fair.
Yeah. And you know, you talked about Biden for a moment there. There were some news reports that Biden and the Australian Prime Minister had discussed Assange, that he was softening up on Assange, that maybe they were going to drop the charges against Assange. Those were whispers, rumors that did not come to fruition. And unfortunately, with this successful prosecution of McBride, that doesn't really bode well for Australia really trying to push the envelope for free speech and care about whistleblowers. So to me, that seemed like a lot of grandstanding on the Australian side. The idea that somehow their government was going to step in and the United States is going to be like, yeah, you know, you're right. That doesn't seem to be happening. So what do you think the position of Australia is going to be if indeed they decide to extradite Assange? Is there going to be more grandstanding where there's like, you know, we just couldn't do anything about it up until the last moment, that midnight, we were trying so hard for Julian and try to play almost the hero, or just play the heel and be like, hey, broke the law. There was only so much we can do. We don't like it, but the United States is going to do what the United States is going to do.
I think there will be some attempt at face saving, especially within the Anthony Albanese government. I think that that's been kind of his position on this since he took office and before he took office. Before he took office, he had many things to say about the Assange case. Enough is enough. He should be brought home, all of that stuff. The second he took office, he immediately shut up. He had to be forced to speak about it after months and months of activists getting on his case about having gone silent. So I think that likely there will be some attempt at grandstanding. I don't think that it's going to, he's not going to be able to sell that with Assange supporters. And we should point out too that depending on which poll you look at, anywhere from 80 to 90% of the Australian public supports the charges against Assange being dropped and him being allowed to come home. Do you have any idea how difficult it is to get 80 or 90% of people to agree on literally anything? And the idea that it is the Assange case, I think, speaks volumes. Australians understand who Julian Assange is. They're proud of him. They're proud of the fact that he is Australian, and they are very frustrated with their government that they have not taken a more active position on this and that they've been very passive. But it's not surprising. And as you mentioned, with the McBride sentencing that we just saw, the United States government thoroughly involved themselves and interfered with that prosecution. They swooped in as it had already started, as those hearings had already started, and they decided that they wanted to make sure that a certain amount of the evidence that had been the McBride defense team was going to present in terms of a public interest defense, they wanted to take that all away, and they were successful in doing that. The Australian court system cowed to them, and it, literally they walked into a courtroom and took paperwork from the McBride defense team and whisked it off so that it wasn't able to, they weren't able to use it in court. So we see the way that the Australian government very much is working at the behest of the United States. They don't have any autonomy. They don't have any sovereignty. They are just another American state as far as everything is concerned.
And that is really scary because once they can step in and they can say, you can't present this evidence, it sets a nasty precedent. And it's already been set in the United States over and over and over and over and over again. Some of the most visible examples are obviously the January 6th cases, where, again, these people were not allowed to present counter evidence or their quotes that were presented by the prosecution in any type of context. The same thing with those in Michigan in the Whitmer plots. They were largely limited to the evidence that they were allowed to present. In the court cases that came about after questioning the elections, they overcharge these individuals. They know that they're going to wage lawfare against them so that they will plead down, because they can say, look, we have a 98% conviction rate and you're not even going to be able to defend yourself. So you might as well play ball. And that's the reality. These situations aren't law and order, everybody. I'm sorry. Ice-T is playing a part. Remember, he was a rapper. That's not the real world. But so many people believe that our court system is like what they see on dramatized television, when good defeats evil most of the time. And when it doesn't, they'll get them next time, Misty. So what is this really say to other whistleblowers around the world and others that want to conduct independent media, or those that may want to put some of this information out, not even being military, just like Julian was simply a civilian working with whistleblowers, putting out real information and then being prosecuted in another country under the Espionage Act? By the way, everybody that doesn't know, the Espionage Act, if found guilty, you can be killed. Like, death is the number one stunner that you can be sentenced to. I'm not saying they would do that to Assange. I think the punishment is the process itself. I think they would imprison him for life. I don't think that they would pull the trigger on killing the guy. But at the same time, that's on the table. It's very frightening.
It is certainly on the table. We know that it's been revealed that it's on the table. And I think that honestly, they've been kind of tap dancing on that line, because I think, frankly, they want him dead, obviously. I mean, there were plots to assassinate him that were developed. So they obviously want him dead. I just think that they recognize that if they kill him, they make a martyr out of him. And that opens up a whole other thing that they have to deal with. So I think that there's a desperate attempt to kind of walk that line and figure out how exactly they can proceed while continuing to save face. But I think that really this just shows that the global attacks on dissent and on journalism and on whistleblowing and on truth, really. I mean, that is what we are facing here. What we're seeing is the United States is seeking global jurisdiction over information and journalism. They want full control of the narrative. They want to be able to control everything that you see, read, think, listen to, know who you can talk to. And they're desperate for that kind of control. And that's really what this is all about. And I mean, you mentioned John Kiriakou earlier, and I think that that's really, I think whistleblowers have always faced that kind of persecution, obviously. Powerful people don't like their secrets exposed. That, I think that's a given. But I think that we saw that maybe beginning with John Kiriakou, maybe a little bit earlier with Jeffrey Sterling or Thomas Drake. But we saw that there was this increased concentrated effort on silencing these types of people. And I think that that's why we saw, I mean, Chelsea Manning was tortured, literally tortured, several suicide attempts within prison. She was held for 7 years, given an unbelievable sentence, 35 years plus. So I think that we're starting to see that they're really hoping to create a chilling effect across. And frankly, they've been successful. I think there's no question about it. They have been successful. I think that we're seeing that in the quality of journalism that exists today. And we're seeing that in the lack of whistleblowing. I know that there are people out there who desperately want to whistleblow, but are terrified to do so. And I think that that's, I mean, I've said about Julian Assange for many, many years now that he is, they're using him as a proverbial head on a stake outside the castle walls. He's the warning. They mean to tell every other journalist across the globe that if you mess with us, this is what we will do to you. And unfortunately, that's been very effective. And I think that it has scared a lot of people from reporting the truth.
Now, you know, going outside of even the realm of journalism, we now have this new anti-Semitism bill that has been ushered through Congress. I'm sure it'll be ushered through the Senate as well, that literally criminalizes thought and speech. And I've said it again and again and again. There is nothing illegal about being an anti-Semite or a bigot in this country. There's nothing. In fact, there should be nothing. I'm not saying that I like what these people say or think, but number one, that definition is a working definition and easily broadened into anything they'd like to call it anti-Semitism. But to me, that's not even the point. The point of the First Amendment is that disturbing, disgusting speech that I may not agree with is allowed. because we don't put people in jail for thoughts in this country. We put people in jail for actual criminal behavior that is harmful to others. And I'm sorry, I don't care. We need to protect the most disgusting of speech, period, amen. And not only have we not done this, we've opened a Pandora's box where it seems if this does get fast-tracked through, we are on the road to thought crimes on a level I had never thought could be possible in a Western nation, let alone the United States itself, Misty.
Yeah. And I mean, listen, there's been a lot of effort put into creating the environment where people are okay with that. And we're starting to see that people are very inconsistent. They're fine with people they don't like being censored, and then they're angry when it happens to them. And that's just allowed this to evolve to this point. And it's really frustrating.
It really is. Again, you shouldn't be calling for censorship on either side. You know, the solution to bad speech is better speech. It's to discussion. It's to discernment and different opposing sides coming together and showing you what they got via that wonderful tool of free speech. Misty, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. Second hour coming up. We're going to get heavy on the AI and ChatGPT. Hello 4.0. You're not going to want to miss it. More of the show after this with TNT.